Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be discussing a subject that, oh my goodness, it's come up so many times in the news, ethics, business. How do you live your life in a way and manner that allows you to maintain your own integrity as well as honoring that integrity with others? My guest today, Dr. Bruce Howard, has put together a wonderful book called Charting the Course, Values for Navigating Life in the Marketplace. Dr. Howard, welcome to the show.
Don, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Now, you are a professor, and you, I believe, are currently with the faculty of Wheaton College, and you're the professor of business and economics. You have a Ph.D. in economics and a master's of administration and accountancy. You're a member of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and you have worked with Tyndale House Publishers since 1980 and serve as a member of their board of directors. And you also have been very much involved in the banking and the healthcare industry. Now, with a man like you that has this kind of a background, what pushed your buttons to put a book together? I mean, I would think you'd be so busy, you'd be lucky if you could have any time to breathe.
Well, that's a good question. Donna, I needed to write this book, and I needed to write it for myself, first of all. As a teacher of college-age students, you know, I get the privilege of working with people 18 to 22 years old, and that's a very formative time of life where they're coming to college, you know, still pretty dependent on their families, and they're leaving college pretty much independent, thinking on their own, standing on their own two feet, ready to make their way in the world. And young people have studied lots of history, mathematics, science, and English by the time they've gotten to college, but they very rarely have they had a chance to study systematically or formally economics. So I have the privilege of taking that discipline and kind of opening up the subject for the very first time with these young people. And it's a great joy. It's a lot of fun. And for many years, I've been very impressed with the power of markets to transform lives for the better. And, you know, I live on the outskirts of Chicago. It's a kind of a urban area, and I don't have to go probably more than four or five blocks to where I can find a store that I can get pineapples that came from Hawaii or grapefruit that came from Texas or beef that came from Nebraska or fish that was caught up in Alaska or down in Chile a day or two ago. And all these things come within a few blocks of my doorstep each and every day. And it's the same is true with most people in highly developed economies, but they don't have to go all that far to find goods and services that they enjoy that make their life better. For many years, I've just been preaching to the kids the power of markets to transform lives for the better. But the more I got into it, and the longer I started thinking about it, I said, you know, what's at the core of this system that I'm such a fan of? And really, it's a worldview, it's a philosophy that's humanistic, that's egocentric, that's relativistic, and it puts you and me sort of at the center of our universe. And we become the ultimate judge of the worth of things. So when we go shopping, part of the whole shopping deal is you kind of go up and down the aisles, you look at the stuff, and you ask yourself, do I think it's worth it? And if we do, we might go ahead and buy it. If we don't think it's worth it, we don't buy it. But behind all that is this sort of human calculus where we're looking at things and we're imputing the value to it. And the worldview of markets really doesn't make much quarter for a system of values that transcend human calculus. Really, human beings become the the arbitrators, and we become the judge of what is and what isn't valuable. And as one who believes in and values that are transcendent, that really are beyond my scope to determine, I was really, really uncomfortable with that. And say, how do I stand up in front of these young people with integrity and tell them, you know, this is a great system for creating goods and services, but at the core of it is a worldview that I'm just not really all that comfortable with. So I was stuck for a couple of years kind of wondering, how do I do this? How do I continue to teach with integrity?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I for a long time, I believed that sometimes your greatest strengths can be your greatest weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that is, well, let's say you're a good decision maker and you're a good problem solver. That's generally a great strength. We need good decision maker, people who are decisive, who are good at solving problems. And your friend comes to you with a problem, and so you get into this decision making, problem solving mode, and you try to fix your friend's problem. Well, that might be good at some point, but initially, what they really want is, would you just listen to me? Don't fix me. Just listen and care about me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what I mean by a strength can sometimes work against you. But when it came to markets, I started thinking about, you know, is it possible that what might be a weakness in another context or from another perspective might actually turn out to be a strength? And so the weakness of markets is that they don't have a conscience. They're morally neutral. Markets can't distinguish between penicillin or pornography, heroin or housing. Markets just reflect back to us the things that we value. And that's a great weakness of the marketplace. But you know what? Markets actually turn out to be really good mirrors. Not perfect, but really pretty good mirrors. And they bring to us the kinds of things that we value. So if you value vanilla ice cream, the market makes sure that you get vanilla ice cream. If you like pistachio ice cream, the market's going to figure out a way to get you pistachio ice cream. And markets, because they reflect values, it seemed to me that, you know, if we're going to be pleased with this system, a powerful system, with all of its outcomes, then it's really incumbent upon us each and every day to bring the right values to the marketplace. And because if we don't bring the right values, we're going to get bad outcomes. If we do bring the right values, then we're going to get good outcomes. And the question then boils down to, well, whose values? What are the right values? And that's what this book is about. And they really aren't my values. I think what I've tried to do is listen and read and talk to people and see, isn't there a consensus of values that people everywhere agree to? Say, yep, this is the world that I want to live in. And you know, I've talked about these things over in Kazakhstan. I've been over there three times teaching. I've talked about these things in Honduras and in Belgium and Germany and England and Netherlands and, Czechoslovakia. And I never got an argument any of those places about these values. People say, yeah, that's the kind of world that I want to live in. They all agree that we're not there,
mm-hmm.
but they agree that, you know, that's what we need to be working towards.
Well, excuse me for just a minute. I'd like to read the values that you've listed in your book and then just take a few of them to discuss them because I know we won't be able to do it in the time that we have. But I want to read them out loud because I think they're important. One, we value people as being more important than things. We value treating other people the same way we want to be treated, with consideration and concern for their interests. We value truth in every context and at every level. We value a world where there is pervasive commitment to improve the welfare of all persons in the environment in which we live. We value living for a cause that is greater than ourselves. We value freedom and individual dignity. We value caring, supportive communities. We value the rule of law and the certitude and stability that come with it. We value being engaged in meaningful, productive vocation. We value a balance of both duty and delight. We value a world where people recognize that choices have consequences. We value a world where society's best principles endure the test of time. Let's take the very first one, because I think so frequently in the busyness of environment, we see so many things going on in the world that really are not particularly pleasant, not particularly positive, and in today's world, communication is in seconds. It's not just in three or four days after the effect, typically. I mean, people with their video cameras, I mean, they're setting up on the Internet, and things go around the world in such a short period of time. It's amazing. People are more important than things. And you have here a quote by Russell Kelfer, "Every decision you make ought to prefer character to circumstances, the spiritual to the temporal, people to things."
Yeah.
That, I think, is very significant. Let's start off with that one.
Yeah, people are more important than things. Donna, every day I need to take a little bit of that and put it on my plate and say, Bruce, you remember, how you want to live today, you need to remember that people are more important than things. And, you know, I don't get much of an argument from that anywhere, but then I have to tell people a story, and there's a good part to this story, and there's a sad part to this story. A number of years ago, I was taking my three kids on a bike ride. My wife was with us, and we were kind of riding our bikes across town at Grandpa and Grandma's house, and we were within a block of our destination when I heard the distinctive sound of metal crunching on metal and breaking glass. And what had happened is my son, who was riding right behind me on his bike, had been distracted watching some kids playing in a park that we were riding our bikes by. And so he didn't notice when I kind of veered off in order to miss this car that was parked along the side of the road. And so my son ran his bike right into the back of this parked car. And Donna, it was a brand new car. Still had the license applied for tag on it. And it was a Porsche. My son had ridden his bike right in the back of a brand new Porsche.
Mm.
Well, that's what the crunching metal sound and the broken glass was. And so the owner of this car was over in the park swinging his little girl on a swing. And this guy saw the whole thing happen. And he came running over, stood right in my face. And you know the first words out of his mouth were?
No.
Is your son okay? Isn't
that
a great story?
That is significant.
Isn't that a great story?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the sad part. Donna, I didn't know. I've been too busy inspecting the damage to the Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sad part. It's probably the lowest part, my lowest point as a father, maybe even as a human being. But you know, 30 seconds before that, I would have sworn on a stack of Bibles that I believe, more than anything else, people were more important than things, and specifically, my son was more important than a Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow, I didn't act that way. I didn't live that way. And, you know, as I tell that story and others similar to it, you know, it's amazing how many similar stories I hear back from people and say, oh, I know what you mean, Bruce. Let me tell you about how a time when I forgot that people were more important than things. In the marketplace, it's a lot about things. We're buying and selling things. But, you know, it's about people. And things don't make markets. People make markets.
Yes.
And I just know that how easy it is to forget the priority of people in economic activity. So because of my own failures and just looking around at the failures of the marketplace, I need to put on my to-do list, Bruce, how are you going to live today? You got to remember, people
mm-hmm.
are more important than things.
Well, I also think that you give some wonderful, wonderful stories about how various companies have responded in a positive way. And, of course, I just received an email yesterday from someone talking about this particular substance that the Chinese had put into their dairy products. It's affected thousands and thousands of Chinese babies. And it came over here. It was in various food products. And all of these things that, you know, that came down and how to look for a code on a package to see where certain things coming from. And I got this and I thought, here we've got this information. Look at how fast this went around a few months back. This is something that's brand new, that's updated. They're asking people to be alert to certain things so that they don't accidentally feed something to themselves, their child, or their animals that could have some of this material in it. And I looked at this and I thought, amazing. What has been the response? The response there was very, very slow. But you talk about a company here, Johnson & Johnson. Now, in 1982, that company was presented with a challenge, and it met that challenge, and all these years later, it is still one of the highest regarded companies in the world. What is the name of that company, and why, and what was it that they did? Why did they do it, and what was it they did that made the difference?
Well, the company is Johnson & Johnson, and the young people won't remember, but many of your listeners probably will. It's when somebody laced some of their Tylenol product with cyanide, and human life was actually lost as a result of that. And as soon as the company became aware of the facts and that someone had done that, they pulled all their Tylenol products off the shelf all over the nation. And to this day, you pick up any book on business ethics, the Johnson & Johnson case set the bar, really, for what good corporate response is to this kind of a tampering with your product. And they understood the priority of people and acted immediately, pulling all their product to the cost of millions and millions of dollars, because they just understood that the Tylenol is a thing, but that thing might actually hurt a person, and better to give up the profits and to pull the things in order to preserve the people.
Which is a significant accomplishment. Truth at all levels. We have today so many examples just in the last 9 months of lies, big time, on the political level. And it's like, well, we can lie today, but tomorrow it's different. And it's just, to me, it's so disgusting. I won't even go into it because I typically don't discuss politics. But it's a real good example of what I feel is a disillusionment, big time, with so much of corporation environment and the environment of leaders. It's like, well, if you can't trust them, if they're saying, well, this is the truth on Monday, and then they lie on Friday, and they say, no, what I told you on Monday is a lie, but this is what I'm telling you today is the truth. You go, excuse me? Give me a break. What is the deal? You have here a quote by William Shakespeare, no legacy is so rich as honesty. This is, I think, a contaminant. We've had comments about teachers permitting stuff in colleges relative to cheating. I mean, there was a big commentary in a major magazine, and it's also been in newspapers off and on. Various things that go on, and it's like in the social mentality on so many different levels in different environments, this is okay.
You know, in my... I used to be an auditor for a large financial institution in Chicago, and being an auditor, I dealt with my share of fraud and theft on the investigative side, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's interesting when you ask people, how do you feel? What are your feelings? What are your emotions when you've been stolen from? The people have the same emotions when they're stolen from as when they're lied to. It feels the same. And I've always been intrigued by that emotive response, that when someone lies to you, it feels like they've taken something from you. And you say, well, how do we get to these big, big lies like the Enron or some of the lies that we've had in the financial services industry in the last 3 or 4 months?
Mm-hmm.
How do people get to the point where they can tell such big lies to so many people? And I believe there's a morphology to lying. People are born with a conscience, and somehow we've gotten into our minds that truth matters at some levels. And I'm arguing that if truth matters at all, then it has to matter at all levels. Because if it doesn't, here's what happens. You wind up telling little lies to people who are far removed from you. And your conscience might bother you. But if you don't change your ways, you get accustomed to that. And once you get comfortable telling little lies to people who are sort of far removed from you, you might tell little lies to people who are closer to you. You might even tell little lies to your friends and family. And then once you get comfortable telling little lies, you start telling little larger lies to people, and you get comfortable with that. People don't come out of the womb telling these great big lies. They kind of work their way up to it. You know, when I was when I got married, my wife and I honeymooned at a place called Mackinac Island. It's a little island up between Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, and Lake Huron, where the three lakes meet. And we didn't know it, but every year in the summer, there's a boat race from Chicago to Mackinac, and it's probably about a 400-mile boat race and sailboat race, and people come from really all over the world to enter this race. It's quite famous, actually, but we never heard of it. And anyway, the first night we were up there on the island, in the middle of the night, I heard this explosion. And I jumped out of bed. I ran to the window, and I looked outside. I said, what in the world blew up? And all was quiet. I thought, gee, I don't know what happened. I must have been dreaming. Went back to bed a few minutes later, another explosion. Well, what we didn't know that any time a boat crossed the finish line up in Mackinac Island, they set off a cannon that was right below the window of our bed and breakfast as sort of a salutary greeting when you pass the finish line. And so every few minutes that night, that this cannon was going off, and I never slept. And some people race from Chicago to Mackinac, and others kind of just use it as time for kind of partying. They go from port to port, and they might take a week to make the race. But they still get their salutary salute when they cross the finish line. So for the next 4 or 5 days, this cannon was going off pretty constantly, or systematically anyway. And the interesting thing was, by the third day, I was sleeping like a baby. And it wasn't that the cannon wasn't going off. It was that I'd gotten used to it, and it just didn't bother me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is with truth. If we buy into this notion that truth only matters at big levels, then what happens is our conscience and our ability to discern good from bad when it comes to truth-telling just becomes diminished. And it's not that the conscience isn't there, it's just, man, it's scarred. We're not hearing it anymore. It just doesn't keep us up at night like it used to. And so we've got to get rid of this notion that truth only matters at some level. If truth matters at all, then it's got to matter at all levels, and it means we need to be truthful in all levels of our life with all people in all our dealings.
You have another chapter, and again, I'm skipping around your book because each chapter has a phenomenal value to it. And for those of you tuning in, I'm interviewing Dr. Bruce Howard, Charting the Course, Values for Navigating Life in the Marketplace. And it is something I feel you could share with a teenager, you could share with business colleagues, friends, family. It's just very, very well done. The chapter on freedom, Use It or Lose It, you have a quote from The King's Cavalier by Samuel Shellbarger. But this freedom demands vigilance, for as a rule, men find it easier to be slaves than free. And any student of history will find that too frequently that is the case. There seems to be those cycles where we fight for freedom, and then the coming generations eventually, because they've never had any involvement in a fight for freedom, have not known anything different, let it erode until they become a slave on one level or another. You give some fascinating information that 85% of the world's 192 countries, 44.27%, are free, meaning that they have a high degree of political and economic freedom and respect basic civil liberties. Another 60 countries, 31.25%, were rated as partly free. And finally, 47 countries, 24.45% of all states, denied their citizens basic rights and civil liberties and were rated not free. When you interact with people from around the world, as you have, and when you are able to see these different variables where there may be a few freedoms but limitations in so many other areas, and you experience their perceptions of tyranny and their fears, it's really an eye-opener, isn't it?
Yes. Unfortunately, slavery is alive and well. In the 2002 issue of the Harvard International Review, they write, conservative estimates indicate that 27 million people in places as diverse as Nigeria, Indonesia, Brazil, live in conditions of forced bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Some sources put those figures 10 times as large. And to put these numbers in perspective, we believe that 13 million slaves were taken from Africa to the transatlantic slave trade, which ended in the 19th century. And today, we have nearly double that number of people living in slavery that we are aware of, and probably three or four times as much that we don't know. So slavery is alive and well, and you don't actually have to be in slavery to suffer some of the conditions that are slave-like. So you think, well, what does it mean to be in slavery? Well, there's an extreme imbalance of power. Your labor is viewed as a commodity. You're like a tool. You're not a person. Coercion is used to achieve compliance. Slaves have little or no control over what kind of work they do, how they do it, or how long they work, where they work, or the conditions under which they work. And there are people who may not be legally in slavery, but that's how their work feels to them. They have mm-hmm. little or no legal recourse. So, unfortunately, the world has fallen. There is evil in the world, and we have to recognize that. And the way that manifests itself in the labor force is by this gravity of society downward towards slavery, or conditions that are slave-like, and we need to realize that. And say, you know what? That's a bad economic outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, if that's a bad economic outcome, what kind of how are we going to rebut that? What's the value that's missing? The value that's missing is freedom and dignity of and the worth of individuals and the rights of individuals to make their own choices and to control their own destiny as much as humanly possible in the economic arena. So that's a value that has to be brought to the marketplace. And we have to work proactively for that because you've got this countervailing force that's slavery, that's pulling society in the other direction. And, the thing I think of in that is a number of years ago, when I was a kid, I was a spring break, and my brothers and some friends and I got some old wood, some lumber, some 2x4s. We were going to build this fort. So we got some nails and these boards, and we took out, and we erected this fort. We were so proud of ourselves. And at the end of the week, we got in our wooden fort, and what happened? The thing just collapsed. We weren't skilled carpenters. We didn't know about what kind of supports that we needed to hold this thing up. And there was this invisible force of gravity always working, and we just didn't have enough countervailing force in the other way to keep that thing up. And the forces of slavery are out there like bad gravity, always pulling the economy down in ways that work against the welfare of the worker. And we need to admit that, recognize that, and then work proactively to hold up this value of freedom and work towards it as a positive force in order to get good economic outcomes as it relates to labor.
Well, Bruce, it has been wonderful having you on the show. I'm sorry we're just about out of time. Dr. Bruce Howard, charting the course, Values for Navigating Life in the Marketplace. There's so much more in his book, very well, very succinctly stated, with content that you could share with just about anyone. And it's good reading. It really is good reading. And if sometimes you get discouraged, you feel that the world gets very dark at times, and you wonder, gee, is there ever going to be a light? There is light. And Dr. Bruce Howard is one of many lights that is out there trying to illuminate people with an understanding that they can make a difference. And I think you've done a wonderful job, Dr. Bruce Howard. Also, I wanted to say his book is in bookstores. He does not have a website at this time, but he will be hoping to get one up eventually. But regardless, go to your bookstore, ask for Charting the Course, Values for Navigating Life in the Marketplace. It's very inspirational. It's practical. But more than anything else, it is something that should inspire you to realize that good values do make a difference. And you can make a difference when you believe in them and you live them to the best of your capability. Dr. Howard, thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's been my pleasure. Have a good evening now.
You too. This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Good things to share. Don't go away.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna, and if you'd like to call in and chat with me today, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Give me a buzz at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Also, Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, if you're a first-time listener to the Donna Sebo Show, we're so delighted you're able to join our listening family. But also know that it's painless to call in. That's right. And what happens is you give me your first name or your initial. Of course, I love to know where you're calling in from. And then after that, I'll tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that might be of interest to you. And I wanted to also give you some information. There are some activities coming up that are going to be quite special. One, I'm going to be doing an appearance at the Dickens Festival, and this is for Western Washington. It's going to be in the Tacoma area. They are having a Dickens Festival at the Stadium High area. And this is just so much fun. I've been invited to participate in this again this year. Now, if you want information on it, you can go to dickensfestival.net, dickensfestival.net, and all kinds of good stuff will pop up. They'll tell you about all the activities that are going on. I am going to be appearing at the King's Bookstore, and I'll be doing many consultations. And, yes, I get to wear a costume myself. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and, of course, the weather is brisk, and they have cider, and they have all kinds of good things at different places, and they even have maps for people to follow to go and experience different kinds of activities and things that are going on. So this is a fabulous event. I'm going to be available for many consultations at this event from 11 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. So I do hope for those of you who are listening from the Western Washington area that you'll have a chance to enjoy this. It's a great way to prepare for the holiday that is coming up. Also, I wanted to let you know, Teresa Tapp is going to be my guest on the 26th. And we are going to be offering, she is offering actually, this wonderful holiday special to three lucky listeners of this show. If you're interested in getting a holiday gift that's worth over $100 and you want to look fit and fabulous for 2009, you're not going to want to miss doing this. You're going to be able to get a DVD on her skin brushing system, which is incredible. I can't speak highly enough about it. and also her workout, which is awesome. It does make a difference, believe me. Now, what you need to do, you need to contact me via email, and in the subject line, put the Donna Sebo Show code DSS30, code DSS30, and I need your name and your contact information, because we're going to be taking your names and putting them in our email pot, and we'll be having a drawing, so you will have this, perhaps. And I'm going to find out from Teresa when we would be able to get it to you. So if you want to be fit and fabulous in 2009, Teresa Tapp is going to be offering this wonderful gift, and you will have a chance to win. So I'm giving you a heads up, a little bit of an earlier notification on this. So send me an email. Again, put in the subject notation, the Donna Sebo Show, code DSS30. And then I need your name and your contact information in the content portion of the email, and we'll just put it aside, and then we'll have a drawing, and you may be one of those lucky people. Believe me, the program is awesome. It really, really works. I know. I use it almost daily. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227, Canadians 888-815-9756. Do you ever feel like you're sort of dragging at times? You just don't know what to do to start feeling a little perky? Well, if you're like me, usually the afternoon drags hit, and you sort of get sort of sleepy sometimes, or you can't figure out what's wrong with you. But if you've been sitting at the computer for hours, or you're just very much involved in something, usually exercise can help. But you know what they've found that's really effective, and that is the fragrance of peppermint. Now, peppermint is very interesting because as an herb, it's been prescribed for goodness knows how many years for stomach pain, if you have diarrhea, it's been used, and there's been an international study done on peppermint. Peppermint tea in particular really soothes indigestion symptoms. And they can be brought on, maybe you're coming down with something, or you have got a discomfort just internally from something you've eaten. The body is just letting you know. Well, Eric Yarnell, who's the assistant professor of botanical medicine at Bastyr University here in the Seattle area, he said a strong peppermint tea is best. And he recommends steeping 2 peppermint tea bags in a cup of boiled water for about 15 minutes, and be sure to keep the brew covered so that the essential oils don't evaporate. You'll see a very slight, just a slight slick of oil, you'll notice. Just tiny, tiny bits of it on top of your tea. And the peppermint tea is so good. And I'll tell you what, if you want an herb that's easy to grow in a pot, if you live in an apartment, you don't need a big garden for this. It just grows. In fact, it's better if it's grown in a pot because it's prolific. It'll take over your garden if you're not careful. I know, because that's what happened in our garden. But there's nothing like taking mint leaves that you have, and you can grow peppermint out in the peppermint mint out in your yard, and just rubbing those mint leaves together, and you can inhale the aroma that comes from those crushed leaves, and oh, it's just invigorating. And it's great to have in the evening, or if you've been under a lot of stress, it's one of the best things that you can ever do for yourself. If you've had a heavy dinner, if you have it after a dinner, it's great. So I agree with Dr. Yarnell. It is absolutely magical. And you can have a candy mint. That's why so many restaurants serve mints, little candy mints like that. They really do make a difference. And those candy canes, well, maybe what you want to do after the holidays are through, if you have an abundance of them, if you're not going to use them for decorations on a tree, if they're in a saran wrap, you know, or a cellophane wrap, you can do it, hang them on a tree, which I've done at different times. But what you can do is just sort of break them up into little pieces and stick them in to something where they don't get the moisture from the air, where they stick together. And then whenever you want something that's just refreshing to have as a snack, it's not going to be much in the way of calories, just pop a little piece of peppermint in your mouth. And it's a combination of things. It really is a feel-good and a smell-good type of an herb. And I'll tell you what, it's great in iced tea, too. If you like iced tea, crush up one of those mint leaves, put it in your tea, and you'll find it has a refreshing, refreshing flavor to it. Ice cold tea, it works there too. This is Donna Siebel. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. Well, they say you can't take it with you. Now, if you have all the diamonds in the world, you just can be covered with them. Well, when it comes time to leave this earth, you're just not going to take it with you. And so many cultures have often felt that when you die, you're going to be left with the finest and the best. Well, archaeologists love it because when they find these things, it's absolutely amazing. And there was a woman that was entombed in a rock about 104 B.C. She was Princess Taiwan, and she was removed from a chamber that was cut into the side of a very low hill about 95 miles from Peking. And that of her husband, Prince Luxing, from another nearby cave was also found. They found 2,800 funeral offerings to ease their passage to the next world. So we think the Egyptians did something. The Chinese, I think, were doing it about the same time the Egyptians were. Anyway, the Chinese Princess Taiwan, she died over 2,000 years ago. And because she was buried in a jade suit, and I've got a picture of this in front of me, it's absolutely amazing. She was covered from head to toe in pieces of jade that were very carefully manufactured, so they made a complete suit for her entire body because they believed that she achieved immortality with the jade. Now, her husband reigned from 157 to 141 B.C. Now, he died before she did, and he was given a similar shroud, and they were laid to rest in these vast tombs hollowed out of a very, very rocky hillside. And when their remains were discovered in 1968, they really were a sensation because of the wealth of the 2,800 funeral offerings that they found all about them. Most spectacular, of course, were these jade suits, each made up of more than 2,000 tiny plates of thin jade, and they were sewn together with gold wire. Can you imagine the labor that went into that? And then, to the nobles of the period, jade symbolized power, and gold symbolized physical incorruptibility. Well, they found that the bodies of both of the individuals were nothing more than dust, really. They just decomposed over the hundreds of years. But these suits were just amazing to see. And they are, you know, there's so much that when we look at images of the past, when we find things like this, of course this was discovered in 1968, but when you find things like this and you're able to read history. History is so fascinating. You realize that we really have a lot in common. Think of the people today that are buried with a pink Cadillac. I mean, there's just all kinds of things that people decide that they want to have with them, and how important it is remembering people. We have our gravestones that are out there. You go to some cemeteries and some of these gravestones and mausoleums are just incredible. We saw a number of different ones over in Russia, but you can't take it with you, but boy, it sure does leave a lot behind for those that come later on that discover whatever is left there. I wonder what will be said about us 1,000 years from now. Who knows? And really, who cares? Because all that's important is how we're living today, right? This is Donna Siebel. We're going to be taking a break in just a moment. And if you wanted to give me a call, give me a buzz at 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. And I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of insight. I will be sharing with you, with time permitting, a woman's story about how she ended up becoming a coach. She didn't know the first thing about the game that she was going to be coaching. This is Donna Siebel. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. Well, I mentioned that there is a woman who ended up becoming a coach for a school, and she was a teacher. She'd been a teacher for 17 years, but Joyce, in a million years, she never, ever would have given consideration to doing soccer. Well, as it happened, with the school she was teaching at, Curtis High School on Staten Island, she said she had just enjoyed very much her teaching positions, and she just loved it. But at the end of this one school year, she noticed a flyer had been posted in the school office. All it said is, "Boys soccer coach needed." Well, she didn't pay much attention to it. She didn't know anything about, you know, about the game. She had, well, let's see, not had too much of an interest in sports. She said the biggest interest she had ever had was for her own boys, little league teams, and she said, my goodness, that had been years before. Well, it went, that note stayed up for a long, long time, and she said, I could have walked away from it, just like most people did, but for some reason, it's as if my feet had a mind of their own, and she ended up walking to the then coach's office, and she said, are you going to have to cancel the season if you don't have a coach? He said, well, if nobody takes the job, I'm going to have to. I don't have any alternative. And she didn't even realize that the words were coming out of her mouth, and she was volunteering. She said, I'll do it. Have you ever found yourself making a statement like that and wondering, where did those words come from? How come I'm saying them? Well, of course, he looked at her a little strangely because he knew she didn't know anything about sports, and he knew she didn't know anything about soccer. She just looked at him and said, I can learn, can't I? So he asked her a question. Have you ever played the game? She said, no. But I know some other people have been involved in coaching. I can work with them. He said, all right, If you want to take on this challenge, your first game is in 2 weeks. And our kids don't even have uniforms at this time. So he said, are you sure you want to get into the middle of this? Her response was yes. Now, the next big step she had to take was to go to a store for sporting goods and to get books on soccer, and obviously she was going to have to learn about it as much as she could. Now, she ended up calling a team into her office, and she said she was fortunate because there were some seniors that were on the team, and there was a nice group of them, and they could help teach the younger kids. Now, she found that the boys that were on this team came from all over the world, and they wanted to know where their coach was. And she said, you're looking at her. Well, can you imagine high school boys seeing a mature woman that doesn't know anything about the game of soccer going to be coaching them? I mean, kids read you instantaneously. They laugh. They absolutely laughed. Now, she said to them, you need to know we're going to be practicing this afternoon. And they looked at her again like she was from another planet because she said, we never practice in the afternoon. And she said to herself, well, that's probably the reason why these kids never had a game where they won anything. She said, well, I'm going to tell you right off. She was totally honest with the kids. She told them that she didn't know a lot about soccer, but she did know about learning. And she said, we're going to have to work and we're going to have to learn together. So let's stop talking and let's start playing. Now, she noticed something right off the bat with these young kids. They never used their names. They always did something like, hey, you in the red shirt, or yo, curly hair. So she asked them, because these kids were from all over the world, she said, doesn't anyone know anyone else's name? They had never, never learned each other's names. So what was the first thing? She had them introduce themselves and assigned each boy a running partner. And then what came up was discrimination. Ah, yes. One of the boys said, I can't run with this boy. He's Egyptian. She said, so what? He said, I'm from Honduras. We don't speak the same language. I'm not going to pass to him. This is going on with all the kids. She said, that was it. She said, this is not acceptable. If I see anyone refusing to pass to someone from another country, I'm going to pull you off the field. I don't care how good you are. She really took an authoritarian positioning. Well, by the time she got home, of course, you know how the kids were responding through practice. They were sulking and doing all kinds of stuff and not being very cooperative. Well, she decided she had to have an agenda. She had to have a plan of working with these kids, and that's what she did. She would never go into a practice without the determined plan of what they needed to do, what they were going to accomplish. And, of course, she was in her free time studying as much as she could. Whenever the kids refused to cooperate with each other, she'd pull them off the field. She wouldn't take any nonsense from them, and they really got their attention. Then her kids started getting better and better. They were in a competitive game 2 weeks later, and they won the game. They then ended up winning another game, and they stopped making fun of her being a woman coach. All of these things evolved because of these kids being taught by a woman that didn't know anything about the game. But she set the standards. She set the values. She set the rules. Well, the kids really started getting involved in a big way because she cared. She cared. She found she ended up being a mom to them. And now they call her Miss Coach. And she said, I even became the legal guardian of one of my players, a West African immigrant named Tambo Beretti. And his parents had sent him to the U.S. to escape civil war in his native country. She said, I've carried these kids around in my car until my car smells like a soccer locker room. That can't be too good. But this woman has made a difference not only in the lives of the kids, but also in her own life. She's found that as a mature teacher, she had something new and exciting that came into her life, a new challenge, and she was up for it. I think Joyce needs to be remembered, and that's why I wanted to tell her story. because she is a woman that decided to take on something that nobody else wanted. When she did, she made it a winning situation and was able to leave a legacy and is still involved in leaving a legacy with the young people that she interacts with. And imagine how that's affecting all of their lives. We're out of time right now. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Just like Joyce, you can make a determination about whatever you choose to get into. And when you do it with values, values of purpose and meaning and example, you are going to make an impression, and you're going to be an inspiration for all of those people around you. We'll be here, right here, BBS Radio, same time, same place, tomorrow. And it's going to be an open mic day, so there's all kinds of good things. And, of course, the phone lines are going to be open throughout the entire hour. Have a fabulous day. See you back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.